show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Bouncing ball, Moustakas, fair ball. Sets, throws, Royals win it. Kansas City, you've got a World Series.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Hey, everybody. This is Michael Engel from the Kansas City Baseball Vault. We are going through some scheduling conflicts. So while the Royals are in pursuit of the AL Central title, Jeff and I can't really come up with the time to record this week. So what we're doing instead, since this weekend will be retro night at Kauffman Stadium, we're going to go with some retro Royals. And so the show that you're going to hear will be some collected interviews that we did back in 2012. To remind any new listeners, at this time, we were doing the Royal Man Report out of Fake Ned's basement, which was just kind of a general catch-up on the week kind of thing. And then during the week, we were also recording at Union Broadcasting for 1510 ESPN. And this show was more about talking to older players, players who had been with the Royals or the old Kansas City A's. This is where the past, present, and future comes into the title that you hear before every episode. So Jeff Logan from the Kansas City Baseball Historical Society would get us a lot of interesting guests. So on this show, you're going to hear Greg Pryor and Buddy Biancalana from the 1985 World Series team. Pryor had a lot of great stories about that entire season and postseason. Biancalana was a great sport about kind of his fleeting fame in 1985. And we also talked to Freddie Patek, who wasn't on the 85 team, but he was a key part of some of the earlier successful Kansas City Royals teams. So this should be a nice trip into the past, a trip down memory lane for some people who were able to see Pryor and Biancalana and Patek. And I hope you enjoy it. We should be back next week with regular discussion of a lot of different things, including some of the playoff teams you're afraid of and, you know, what the Royals need to do to clinch the division, which should be coming up in about a month. So without further ado, let's talk to some old Royals players and let us know what you think about some of these old interviews. We've got a whole bunch of different guys that we've talked to in the past. So if you like this, we can always throw some of these into a show. I think it's interesting because some of them have been from 3 or 4 years ago. And if you haven't heard them before, I think it's usually worth your time. So let us know what you think at KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com. You can always find us on Twitter at KCBaseballVault. We're also on Facebook, just KC Baseball Vault there as well. So should be easy to find us and give us some feedback. Thanks.
We are super excited. We are going to start the show with a bang because we are going to bring on to the Kansas City Baseball Vault today a World Series champion, 1985 World Series champion. Buddy Biancalana is with us on the Kansas City Baseball Vault. How are you tonight, sir?
Great, Jeff. How are you?
We're doing fantastic, man. That's awesome. We were talking a little bit before the show. Tell us a little bit about your 1985 season. I mean, you didn't play a whole lot, and then suddenly Dick Houser pointed at you and put you in for Onyx Concepcion, and the rest was kind of history, wasn't it?
Well, not only did I not play a real lot, I didn't play well when I played. I played well enough down the stretch to get the nod in the postseason, and something very magical happened to me in that postseason, and I ended up playing the best baseball I'd ever played, and the rest is history. It's just a great time in my career, and I know a fun time for Kansas Cityans as well.
We have your statistics up here on the screen, and your career OPS was .553, yet in the World Series it was .713. You had five hits, you had five walks. It's pretty clutch, man.
Well, something very special happened to me in that series. I had a zone experience, which is kind of what has led me to our zone training program that we now teach to many athletes in many different professional amateur sports. Everything just slowed down for me in that series for whatever reason. And for the most part, my intellect shut down. I wasn't thinking, and my swing and play at shortstop was more fluid than it had ever been before. I felt like I just had a lot more time, and literally I had the feeling that I couldn't do anything wrong. I didn't want to say that because I knew the baseball gods are always watching, and that would have been the kiss of death. But, you know, it was just a very special moment in my life and my career, something that really led me to searching for, you know, that zone experience that is so fleeting for all athletes.
Well, I would think if you're going to have a good week, the week of the World Series would probably be a good one to have it. That ended up, that got you on David Letterman. That got you, you know, you're a published author now. You've got the training program. That's pretty good time to have a good week, wouldn't you say?
Well, I like to tell people that one bad call from an umpire changed my whole life. And the timing was good, you know. It, who knows why. All I know, Jeff, is I was sitting in my locker before Game 1 of the World Series. I read about this in our book, The Seven Secrets of World-Class Athletes. I was sitting in my locker before Game 1 of the World Series, and, you know, as a kid, I always knew I wanted to play in the major leagues. There was this, you know, growing up, that was it. I knew at 6 years old I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player, and I was fortunate to do it. But I never once ever thought about playing in a World Series. Even when I was in the big leagues, it was just too big an event. It was like something that was something I would just watch on TV every October in front of the fireplace. But I recall sitting in front of my locker before Game 1 of the series, and I had about 20 minutes to go before ABC wanted us in the dugout for introductions. And all of a sudden, this massive wave of fear just overtook me, to the point where I said to myself, oh, my God, how can I go play right now? You know, and the thoughts of, you know, making an error that could cost us a series or letting down my great teammates and management and the fans of Kansas City, those thoughts started to percolate from the depths of my mind all the way to the surface level. And it was really, really intense. But, you know, I remember sitting there thinking, okay, what am I going to do? And I just sat there for the first time in my life with this nervousness or butterflies, or, you know, it's what it is, it's fear. And usually I would go and mood alter by making myself a sandwich, but with only 20 minutes left to go, I couldn't do it. I wasn't going to go eat a sandwich with 20 minutes to go before the game. So I just sat there with it, and that's the first time that I really experienced how fear can either be your friend or ally, because it really, your friend or enemy, it really became my ally. And it's what really freed me up to get to my full ability and have that zone experience.
Hey, hi, buddy. This is Jeff Luggett from the Kansas City Baseball Historical Society. And we always have a packed house in here with a bunch of guys. And Chris was talking to you earlier. And you came here in 1982. Who scouted you and brought you to the Royals?
Well, I was scouted. I grew up in California. I was scouted by Art Lilly and Rosie Gilhausen and Al Kupski, three scouts that I think, actually Art Lilly is the one who got credit for signing me. And the poor guy drafted me ahead of Cal Ripken. We were both shortstops, and I was drafted ahead of Cal. And I was telling someone that story yesterday. So, but Art is the one who got credit for signing me. You know, I was drafted by the Royals. I was telling someone, you know, because we just had the draft here the last few days, and I was telling someone ahead, no idea that the Royals had any interest in me until the morning of the draft, when John Schuerholz called me and said that they were going into the draft and that they were planning on drafting me first. Would I be interested in signing? And I said, if all things were right, I would be. But I had no idea they were signing me or drafting me. I thought Pittsburgh or Cincinnati was going to draft me, but they were the ones. You know, and at the time, this is 1978. There wasn't a lot known, at least for me in Kansas City, in California. I didn't know anything about Kansas City. The only thing I knew was George Brett played for the Royals. And other than that, I had no idea where Kansas City was. So getting drafted by them was quite a shock. And, you know, I just didn't know what it was all going to entail. But, it turned out to be just a great stepping stone in my life and career.
Well, you both had similar careers, you and Cal. You both won one World Series championship. So, you know, not too bad.
We were very similar players. You're right.
Yes. Both shortstops, both World Series champs. What more do you need to talk about? Who were some of the characters you played with when you were here in Kansas City?
You know, as many games as Cal played, that's how many games I sat the bench in my career in the minor leagues and all. So that's another similarity that you missed there.
Well, you probably don't want to compare yourself to Cal, you know, any player. That's kind of a bad comparison. So
Right.
Talk to me a little bit about, I mean, your perseverance. I mean, you did say that you sat a great deal of the first few years on the bench. You sat a great deal of the 1985 World Series on the bench. What was your mindset the first few years as a player and being able to switch that, to your phrase, the zone phase so well? I mean, you sat the bench for 3 years. You didn't get a lot of hits. What was going through your mind at that time?
Well, you know, as a young player, you know, you come up and you're just trying to survive initially, and then you're trying to be productive and contribute. And I'm not sure I ever got to the point where I was overly productive and contributed a lot until the World Series. And you know, as far as the zone experience goes, that, you know, if you speak to 100 athletes and you ask them how did they feel when they were playing their best, typically they'll describe their experience in the following ways. They'll talk about time slowing down. And they'll talk about their intellect shutting down. They weren't thinking, and their swing and motion was more fluid and effortless. And it's something that, until now, just kind of comes upon a player. They have this experience, and it's when they're playing their best, and then maybe the next day or the next week, it's gone. And that's what happened to me in the World Series. But my partner Stephen Yniel and I have been able to quantify those processes of the brain that are taking place when any athlete in any sport is playing their best, and we've had this proven by neuroscientists. And we have a systematic way of teaching it through drills and concepts that are taught on the field, not sports psychology, a completely different field. And that's what we're able to do. The name of our golf program is Quiet Mind Golf. The name of our other sports programs is called Zone Training, zonetraining.net. So it's a very revolutionary program. We've had some tremendous success stories. In fact, with some ex-Royals there, we've really turned them around. Bobby Keppel, Philip Umber, Jorge De La Rosa are all players that have experienced our program that have gone on and done very, very well with it. And we've worked with athletes in 7 professional sports now and 13 amateur sports because the program is universal for anything that involves motion. We've quantified those processes in the brain that that cause fluid motion, whether you're walking down the street, walking down the steps, or stepping in the batter's box at Kauffman Stadium trying to hit a fastball.
Now, are these training drills? Is this something that you're supposed to eat to try to, you know, get your body chemistry right, or is this just a collection of just about everything to make a zone athlete?
Well, you know, there are a lot of things that go into an athlete playing their best, not just processes of the mind, but we've quantified those processes in the brain that have to take place. And so we use drills and some techniques and concepts that are taught on the playing field that when the athlete does these drills, it causes them to experience time as it's occurring, causes their intellect for the most part to shut down and think from a very, very quiet level of the mind, and causes the fast twitch, the more subtle muscles in the body, to become very, very enlivened, and therefore the bigger muscles, the bulkier muscles, just play a backseat, more of a supporting role, which is what we want in sports. We don't want the big muscles to dominate the swing or the pitching motion or the serve if you're a tennis player or the shot if you're a golfer. We want them just to support and have those fast twitch muscles really, for the most part, dominate the motion so that you have perfect timing and fluidity of motion.
That's fantastic. Where can folks find out a little bit more about this philosophy?
Well, our golf program, again, is quietmindgolf.com. And our book is The 7 Secrets of World-Class Athletes. That's available on Amazon. You can also get that on zonetraining.net. I'm throwing a lot at you right now, but hang with me. Zonetraining.net is our number one website. And there's a lot of information on there. But as far as the golf program goes, the golf DVD is available at quietmindgolf.com. We were just asked to present at the PGA show coming up in January. We're doing some wonderful things in the golf world and other sports as well.
So you would say your career handicap is better than your career OPS? is that fair?
You know what? I'm not much of a golfer, but the beautiful thing is I don't have to be to work with golfers with what we teach. You know, so I work with a lot of professional golfers and amateur golfers, but don't have to play. So, but I'd like to start playing.
That's fantastic, Buddy Biancolana. Thank you so much for joining us on the Kansas City Baseball Vault. It's you're our very first World Series champion we've had on the show. So,
beautiful.
We're honored to have you, and get back to Kansas City soon.
Beautiful. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Thanks. Very much.
Bye bye.
That was Buddy Biancalana on the Kansas City Baseball Vault. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the draft. We're going to talk about the Kansas City Royals. We're going to talk about baseball in Kansas City, and we're going to talk about all kinds of stuff. We'll be right back. Thanks to Buddy Biancalana for being on the show. That's really, really cool. I mean, the guy, he wasn't a very good baseball player. I mean, let's be honest with you, except he was for 2 weeks out of his entire career.
He was good when
career.
It counted.
He was good when it counted, and that gets him a ring. And the ring all
I can't
all
remember
the
last time we
George
won
Brett's
the World
ring.
Series, yeah. But I think he was real good that year.
He was real good that year, so that's awesome.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages. The Vault.
Kansas City Irish Fest is going to be September 4th, 5th, and 6th this year. And as always, Kelly's Westport Inn is the official after party for any KC Irish Fest attendee. When the ceremonies finish up at Crown Center at 11 p.m. each night, Kelly's Westport Inn becomes the destination to grab a pint and celebrate your Irish heritage. On Saturday and Sunday nights, there will be shuttle buses that will take you from Irish Fest at Crown Center all the way to Westport. That's all happening Labor Day weekend, September 4th, 5th, and 6th. Irish Fest until 11, and then Kelly's Westport Inn.
Moments ago, I had a very well-used World Series ring on my finger, so that was pretty cool. So
that's the second World Series ring I've held now.
Yeah.
I love this show.
And until probably later tonight, I have the same number of rings as LeBron James. So there's that. One man who does have a ring and is with us tonight is Greg Pryor of the Kansas City Royals. He played in 63 games in 1985. And was a member of that championship team. Mr. Pryor, welcome to the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
It's great to be here and surrounded by so many knowledgeable baseball people tonight.
Well, and Troy's here too, so let's not forget Troy is also in attendance. Just kind of keying off of Brian Peña's interview, that guy, it makes you kind of want to go out and play again, doesn't it?
Well, he seems like a real humble young player, and I'm very impressed. I liked him. I've liked him for a while. They said his defense was suspect, and so be it. I played with a lot of guys that were great major league players that weren't very good on defense. I liked his ability to hit from both sides with some power, and his attitude is great, and that's hard to find. You can't find it all of it, and he's got a lot of quality, and I think he'll be in the big leagues, whether it's with these roles or with another team, if they will let him go.
Now, coming back from break, we heard Denny calling the last out of the 85 World Series. Tell us a little bit about 1985 and what that year was like, living it, and what it means to you today.
Well, after I've been out of the game a few years and learned about the history of the Royals and the pain that they went through in the late 70s, early 80s, getting into the playoffs or close, losing to Oakland, losing to New York, and then coming here, being around these guys that have been hardened by the pain of losses in playoffs, not the pain of losses as a team, but you get to a certain point where, you know, are you ever going to be able to really go all the way? So I was able to step right into that, and I didn't really appreciate it until I got out of the game when I learned about all the pain they went through before I got here. But in 84, we beat the Tigers, or we played in the Tigers, lost three games to lose the American League playoffs. They went on to sweep the Padres, I think. So, but we had that unfulfilled feeling. Mm-hmm. And then George obviously was having to, you know, rehab because he didn't play that much in 84, thank goodness, because I got a contract after that. So he came back full of fire in 85, and he obviously carried us. And we had other guys that had still that desire. We were coming off of the cocaine problems that we had in 83. Mm-hmm. 84 was like a cleansing, if you will. In 85, everything came together. You know, the young pitching, the experienced guys. And then John Schuerholz made some incredible deals that I don't think any deal that Schuerholz made that season backfired, because we mm-hmm. got Omar Marino in September, and he drove in more runs in 1 month than anybody on the team. But unfortunately, he didn't get a ring or a World Series share. But no, Omar Marino was a great addition to that team. Plus all the pitching. I think we got Steve Farr during that season. So it was just a combination of things, and everything happened good. It was a perfect storm that got us to the top.
That year is interesting because in 1985, they actually changed the league championship series to where it was a 7-game series instead of 5. If you'd have had the same matchup against the Blue Jays, you guys, you know, we wouldn't even have the 85 World Series team. When you guys came back against Toronto, was that something that helped to buoy you towards beating the Cardinals when you came to that same 3-1 deficit?
Well, you know, it was all, you know, the last 30 days of that season, we were on walking the gangplank the whole month. It wasn't like anything was going to be more extravagant because we had been, you know, we came into the last 3 days of the season having to win the division. So it was just a carryover. When Danny Jackson won that third game here, then we had to go up and play, you know, the last two games in Toronto. You know, who would want a World Series in a football field? That's what an exhibition stadium was up there. It would have been so bad for the Cardinals to have to go play in that football field up there with before they built the, what's the name of that field in Toronto?
Skydome.
It's Rogers Center.
Yeah. You know, and they had a wonderful team, but I think that they're in immaturity. I think they thought that they weren't going to lose two at home. They weren't going to lose three in a row. But they lost on a Sunday afternoon here. Then we went up and took two, and it carried over. But, you know, obviously it almost didn't because we went down to the wire with the Cardinals.
You played in 63 games that year, and you played every infield position. You had a game at DH looking at the stats. Looking at it, what must that have been like to not know where you were playing on any given day?
Well, you know, toward the end of my career, obviously, because I got let go after the 86 season. But toward the end of my career, I was more into – I knew I wasn't going to make too much more money because I was literally 35 or 36. but I was really into us winning because I loved the guys on the team. What a great bunch of guys. All that good attitudes, thinking about winning every day you come to the ballpark, expecting to win, knowing there's going to be 30,000 average in the stands every game. I mean, it was one of those things where I was just loving every day of my life at that time, even though I wasn't playing much. But I did get in a game in the last week of the season, and it was – I don't know why George didn't play that game, but I played third base when Buddy Black pitched. And I remember I made a turn a double play against the Angels. Bobby Gritch hit a ball down the line, and we turned a double play, and it just inspired – I looked at the dugout, and everybody was off their feet. So, you know, you always want to play on a winner. But then when you get in the games when you have to make the play or it could mean a division, that's when it really means something. So it was meaningful for me, but I didn't play as much that year as I did the year before, but I still felt I was a good part of the team.
I was at an event out at Kauffman today. It's a corporate event. They had it all rented out, and Willie Wilson was out there telling stories, and he was talking about the story I heard him was telling about what it was like working for you and Kauffman, and he told this amazing story about that he was like your dad, and you wanted to go out and win something for your dad. What are your impressions of working for the Kauffmans?
Well, unfortunately, when I got here, it was toward the end of his career as an owner, and he was watching the influx of or the ramifications of collective bargaining. So when I got here, we had a meeting up in Kauffman Stadium, or back then Roll Stadium. And I was invited to come into the meeting. It was a bunch of players and Mr. Kauffman talking because it was about a strike. I think it was a 2-day strike during the 85 season. And God, he didn't look directly at me. He says, "You know, what's this game coming to when the backup infielder's making $300,000?" It was like, "Oh, that hurt." So
now the backup infielder's making $1.5 million.
Exactly.
$2 million if you're Uniasky Betancourt. You're a backup infielder.
So back in the days, you know, he came through and guys, you know, the minimum salary in 85 was like $30,000. It's like, you know, so back when Kauffman was thinking about all this money that these players were going to get out of the pot, you know, he wasn't too pleased with it. And, fortunately, he got to live long enough to see that World Series.
Speaking of that World Series, I've always wondered from the standpoint of a player, World Series, Game 6, there's obviously, I mean, we're never going to hear the end of it in Kansas City and in St. Louis between this, the call from Dinkinger. When that happens, during the game when that happened, and then afterwards, what was it like in the clubhouse? What was the talk going on around that? What was just the attitude about that call, and what did you kind of use from that?
Well, building up to that, obviously, it was one of the more tense games I've ever played in, being scoreless and being one run down going into the ninth. But the ABC cameras were being the cords were being taped down in our clubhouse. They were laying the wires, and Dane Orge were up there. Orta was up there. Hal McCray and I was up there getting loose in case we needed to go in. We weren't talking to each other. We was just like pacing. And I went up to the camera guy. I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "We're getting ready to tape the losing team here." You know, it's like, you know, he felt like slugging him.
Wow.
And it was like, my gosh, this is, this can't be happening that we came this far. We're not going to lose this game. And then, you know, the call that, a lot of people don't really, I mean, if I had more time, I'd take you through the whole sixth game.
Yeah, there's like nine things that happened after that call.
Well, every time I bring that up, my dad always comes back and he says, oh, well, Frank White was called out at second and they did a pop fly on the foul. But anyway, continues.
Well, you know, in the first inning, the National League umpire called George Brett out with a man on third with one out on a high inside pitch. They rang him up and nobody remembers that. That was a ball that he called him out on. But the only thing that's bad for an umpire is you make a call like that where they say it meant the game, but it didn't mean the game. And you know, had the Cardinals beat us that year, they would have been the World Series champion with the lowest batting average in history. Now, they didn't want that. They didn't want to wear that moniker the rest of their lives.
I'm glad they don't have to. Yeah.
Well, I've watched that play over and over, and he was safe. He beat the play. There's no doubt. You know, if you really look, his toe.
Somebody
want to
smell his cup and see what you he's know? Drinking right now? I mean,
these Cardinal fans, they're just, you know. Just
think if instant replay was in baseball more than it is. I think that would have changed baseball history.
We saw the same thing in the last Royals and Cardinals series where that crazy play where Moustakas makes the throw home and Quintero's got the plate blocked. And everybody on Twitter that's a Cardinals fan was ranting and raving that he was safe. And there's a still photo of the player, you know, the runner's foot, the catcher's foot. So what... When you're playing the Cardinals, I know George Brett has said things that, you know, the Royals hated the Yankees, but is there any kind of the same animosity towards the Cardinals?
No, I think the Cardinals are one of the best organizations in history. Those fans, you could feel the intelligence of fans when you go into Busch Stadium, and they got 11 championships, and they've won two since the 85. So, you know, the Cardinals fans
they
shouldn't complain, and they've had a great run. You know, La Russa, I was a player with the White Sox when he was a rookie manager in Chicago, and he's come a long way. He as a rookie manager of the White Sox, he would get ready to go out and argue. He'd turn around and look on the bench, and he'd ask the bench if the guy was out or safe. On his way out to argue, that's how far he came in baseball.
Who was some of your favorite coaches and managers?
Well, you know, Bob Lemon was my first real big league manager. I made two errors one time as a rookie with the White Sox at shortstop, and I thought I was done. You know, because a lot of times you do something bad as a young player. He put his arm around me after the game, and being a Hall of Fame pitcher, and I didn't say hardly anything to him. He says, "Hey, man, you're back in there tomorrow." And, oh, man, it almost like I became another player after he did that to me, because I said, "Hey, Greg, you know, if he's going to have confidence in you, let's get it done." He was wonderful. And then, you know, I got to play with Don Kessinger as a player manager. Kessinger, a former Chicago Cubs shortstop. He was playing shortstop for the White Sox. I was playing second, and it was really a thrill to be able to play infield with your manager. That was different. But Dick Houser was probably my favorite because he gave me a job for five straight years, and you know, he was always positive. We're both from Florida. He from Florida State, me from Florida Southern, and he knew me when I was with the Yankees. When Billy Martin didn't want me. So I think Houser, he appreciated me the more he saw me play. And I was the kind of guy that, you know, I was kind of a boring player, but I did the same things every time. I was very consistent with everything I did, and that's why I played as long as I did.
We're talking with Greg Pryor on the Kansas City Baseball Vault. I think what we're going to do a trivia question, then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and do another segment with Greg. Trivia question is Greg Pryor oriented, so listen up. Here is your trivia question. Greg Pryor was drafted in the sixth round of the 1971 amateur draft. Please tell me what team drafted Greg Pryor. We were talking during the break about how old we were when the 85 World Series, and I don't want to talk about how old I was. Jeff Herr was 6 months old, and then that led into another discussion where Greg asked Jeff, "Have you heard of the Disco Demolition Night?" And Jeff has never heard of that. So
what?
I do know for a fact, Mr. Pryor, what is your relationship to Disco Demolition Night? You were the shortstop in that game, were you not?
Yeah, the White Sox. Mike Vec, the owner of Bill, the son of Bill Vec, was going to do a promotion with Steve Dahl, who was the number one rock station disc jockey in Chicago. And if you brought a 33 and a third record to the game, you got in for a reduced rate. And back then, that was one of those big 33.
A record, yeah, a record.
That's a big record. What's the record?
I'm going to hit Jeff in the face.
One of them big things at the needle.
It's like a giant CD.
They were collecting these records. And between games, they were going to put them in center field in a big pile and put dynamite under them. But the record had to be a disco. This was blow up. This is we're going to blow up disco.
Disco is dead.
Because the anti-disco people were at the game. 44,000 young people brought banners in. And you can go there. It's online. You can go look at videos and pictures. And I'm out there at shortstop looking up in the stands, and it was the most eerie feeling in the world.
And they were all drunk. They're all hippies and drunk.
You know, whatever they were doing. Sure. They weren't watching the game.
Right.
They could care less. They were throwing records on the field. So we won. We lost the first game. And we go in the clubhouse to get dressed for the second game. Because
they were doing it between.
Yeah, between games. They're going to blow up, and we're looking at it online right now. And I'm going to play short the second game, too. And the starting pitcher walked by my locker, and I said, Kenny, aren't you pitching? He says, Greg, there's a riot going on. You need to go look. So I jumped in my skivvies, and I'm running out to look in the out in the dugout to see what I can see. And they had stormed our clubhouse. They're coming up in the runway through the dugout into our clubhouse, and our equipment manager had a bat up. He said, take one more step, and you've had it. He was getting ready to beat some guys that were trying to take over our clubhouse. So they got him off the field. Or get him out of our clubhouse, and he put a big wooden plank on the door that I'm going to get in. And then we were there for an hour and a half, waiting until it subsided. We heard mounted police outside our clubhouse. And later, we found out that the American League president forfeited the second game to the Tigers. Bill Veeck had to pay a big fine, and the field was demolished. And as we're looking on the thing, they definitely blew up.
Well, they just tore it to shreds.
The night they blew up Comiskey Park is basically what it was.
Now that's baseball.
Yeah,
we've now had stories about drunk monkeys running through the clubhouse and disco-hating music bands.
I like where the show is going.
Up
that's great.
With dynamite! So.
I love it. That's fantastic.
That
is a
beautiful video.
The video is incredible, and just from the tales that you hear on like MLB Network, it's just they blow it up, and then everybody just rushes the field, and they literally shred Comiskey Field. Now that wasn't the only chaotic event that your baseball career is intersected with. You were also on the field for the Pine Tar game as well.
I was in the bullpen. It's the only time in my 9-year career where I had to go to the bullpen during the game. And for some reason, we had both catchers in the game. Dick Houser said, go to the bullpen. I'm out there. George hits the home run, and we're looking at the scrum and home plate. I'm looking at it from the bullpen. And all of a sudden, you know, Rocky Colavito and Gaylord Perry took the bat, and they tried to steal the pine tar bat. Yeah. They're running in our dugout with it. The police got them. They got thrown out of the game. Georgia got thrown out. Houser got thrown out. The game was over because they canceled the game because of too much pine tar on the batter. They called George out. So, I don't know, 4 to 6 weeks later, after American League president Lee McPhail turned the decision over, we fly back into Newark, take a bus to Yankee Stadium. There's two outs in the top of the ninth. And we got one out. Then we got them out. We go back in the clubhouse, took a shower, get back on the bus, go to Newark, and then flew to Baltimore to open up the next night. So it was one of the more weird experiences of my
life. I remember watching that game, and I was so excited because the buildup was just so intense. The buildup to the resumption of that game, and they came on with the same intro that they come on, and literally the game lasted like 12 minutes.
Well, you might think it's weird, but I was very, very nervous for that game because, you know, I'm thinking, what if I get three shots down here at third base? Because I was in at third base. I'm on the scorecard.
Yeah, and they had the Yankees had a weird defensive lineup. They had
Martin
a pitcher.
Was so mad.
He was mad.
Well, he came out and protested that one of the runners in front of George missed second base.
They pulled out an affidavit of the umpires before,
because it was a different umpiring crew, and they had an affidavit that said the umpires verified that everybody touched the base, so he had to go back in the dugout. But we get back on the plane in Newark, and George is holding up a bunch of money, and he had sold his pine tar bat to some guy he went to eat with during the baseball game. So he's waving the money in the back of the plane.
Just an update on the trivia question. Greg Schaum won, but he did not want the ticket, so we have one more winner. And Dave Zook is
Nice.
The other winner. So
very cool.
So
we'll tell you
one
what.
One set of tickets to give
away. If somebody, the first person to tweet the Washington Senators
we
to us at KC
then.
Baseball Vault, we can.
Dave Zook.
We can do this.
Dave Zook's listening to the show from Atlanta.
Is he really?
Yeah, he listens
online.
Well,
he needs to come down and make that happen.
Dave, we do this every week. Okay, every Thursday. Keep listening.
That's right.
Is it going to make you guys mad if I say I don't know what the Pine Tar game is either?
Yeah, that's really going to make us mad.
You've lost your mic over that one.
We are now short, by the way.
Hey, that was totally a joke.
If we're going to do a Twitter winner, let's just go ahead and give it. We had one that came in earlier.
Fantastic.
To Talon 1984, Timothy Allen. Tim, shoot one of us a direct message with your name and phone number, and we'll get you on the list.
And you were the last Washington Senator drafted to play Major League Baseball.
Well,
according to Wikipedia.
I thought that was true, but I think Bill Madlock played longer than I did.
You mean, are you telling me Wikipedia is wrong?
There's the one more
Wikipedia,
mistake.
The internet is never wrong, Greg
You know what?
Pryor.
This is our show, and we can do whatever the heck we want. You were the last Washington Senator
no
ever. Go-backs.
I don't want to be.
You know.
No go-backs.
Yeah. I'd rather,
do you like the Senators' uniforms better than the what are they? The Nationals? They're
Nationals.
I don't even know what they are.
The Senators. Back then, they were wearing flannel. You know.
Oh yeah.
It was a hot day.
Did you keep all your uniforms from the teams that you played on?
I do. Yeah, I should have worn my old Senators uniform tonight.
The cleats.
I always thought if I was a professional athlete, and I was pretty close. You know, I was pretty good back in my day.
Yeah.
But
you still have four years remaining on your NCAA
eligibility. But I always thought it'd be cool. I'd keep all my uniforms. I think
you know, when I was with the White Sox, we wore the old the big lapel jerseys.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
with the shorts?
Yeah.
Did you wear shorts?
I missed the shorts by a year.
Oh, my gosh.
Well,
Thank God.
I was going to say, you're probably not too unhappy that you missed that era.
Greg, what are you doing with yourself nowadays?
I run a nutrition company, lifepriority.com. LifePriority, lifepriority.com, and sportsaholic.com. And I brought you guys gifts from sportsaholic.com and Life Priority. And each of you is going to get a gift from both my companies.
You sure you brought them?
Well, Michelle packed them up.
This
thanks,
is,
Michelle.
Okay, I just want to get that cleared up.
This is show 7, and the catering company that sponsors the show still hasn't brought us any gifts. So, you know, just say it.
As long as
it
pays the bill.
Yeah, this is a good point. The checks haven't bounced yet.
It seems
so
like
good.
One of those catering companies, the guy from that, brought the Royal Suite tickets one night.
He did.
That's a good point. Yeah. All right. That's fine.
Okay, just because you were on assignement again.
Gosh, man.
You were on assignment last week. You know,
I absolutely was. Dan Quisenberry, we were talking to Buddy Bianculon a couple weeks ago. We've got about 2 minutes remaining. Tell me a little bit about Dan Quisenberry. This guy, just everything I read about him, he's just a fascinating, fascinating guy.
Yeah, for a pitcher, he was one of the best guys in the world because, you know, players and pitchers, we don't mix like oil and water a lot of times. But Quiz was more of a player. He was just wonderful. In fact, when the ball went around the infield and I got it back at third base, he liked to hear his glove pop. You know, when you threw the ball to him, he liked to hear it smack. And I just, one night I got really cocky and I decided to throw an underarm back to him like he throws to home plate. And I threw it as hard as I could and it just about nailed, I mean, he didn't expect it and hit his glove and it smacked. And he looked at me, his eyes got big. He goes, "Hey," he says, "quit that. You're throwing faster than me." And he was the humblest guy. He was so much fun. Everybody loved him. I mean, I cried so hard when he passed.
And he's on my all mustache team too. My Mount Rushmore.
You have
team.
An all mustache team
yeah.
too? I thought I was the only one.
No, I've got.
Oh my!
I had Greg Pryor on there, and I had Quisenberry, and who was my other guys on there? Now
Shane Summers is on my all mustache team.
Yeah, you know Leonard. There were so many great mustaches back then. Now it's just boring.
You know what? We all need to grow a mustache. New show rule.
Yeah.
This is all
you
I can do.
I don't think Jeff Hurd can grow a mustache.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages. The Vault.
Hi, this is Ned Baudette for Kelly's Westport Inn. Summertime is here, and that means one thing. Your neighbor's cat sneaks over and craps in your garden. No, of course, I'm just joking. Summer also means my neighbor borrowing your boat trailer and driving it into Smithville Lake, or mosquitoes, or your three-year-old drinking the air conditioner water. Haha, I guess what I'm saying here is that summer means different things to different people. And for 65 years, Kelly's Westport Inn has been a vacation for those summer problems ever since Randall Kelly poured his first frosty draft in 1947. 102 degrees and 99% humidity? Don't worry, Kelly's is air conditioned and the drinks are as cold as ice. And when the heat breaks, Randall's Rooftop is ready for you to kick back, where you can head downstairs for some of the best live music in town. Summer is different things to different people, but to everyone in Kansas City, Kelly's Westport is your summertime bar. I'm Ned Badette for Kelly's Westport Inn. We'll leave the taps on for you.
Royals Hall of Famer, played 13 seasons with the Pirates, Angels, and Royals, and, of course, played with the greatest Royals teams of all time, Freddie Patek, their shortstop. Freddie, welcome to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, sir.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate it. It's nice for you to remember.
Oh, I absolutely remember, because you were my guy growing up, and I was a little bigger, stockier guy. I was more of a John Mayberry type, but I always enjoyed watching you play and watching your aggressiveness and your spirit out on the field. You certainly played the game as it needed to be played.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that's something that a lot of our guys did back in our generation, and not to say that the guys nowadays don't do that, but they certainly do. But I think it was just the love and the passion for the game that, you know, allows guys like that to do that. And I certainly wish I were still out there playing.
Of course, you were the anchor of the AL West champion teams of 76, 77, and 78. Do you have a favorite of those teams? I think Royals fans would probably say the 77 team was the greatest Royals team of all time, but what was your favorite to play on?
Well, I think that's pretty accurate. 77, we really did have a great ball club, and I thought that year we were going to go to the World Series and win it all. Unfortunately, some guys from back up east in New York changed our plans for about three consecutive years. But, yeah, we were a good, solid ball club. We just it would have been nice if we would have had a best four out of seven series than the old best three out of five. So we did. We had a lot of talent on that ball club and certainly knew how to win ball games. And that went a long way all the way through the 70s and even up to 1985.
Now, of course, those Royals teams were famously built on pitching and speed. You had some of the greatest Royals pitchers of all time, and you had speedsters like Willie Wilson and all those guys, yourself included. You played in a Royal stadium that's basically configured the same way today. What made those teams so successful in your mind?
Well, I think we had a combination of everything, just as you had mentioned, but we did. We had a lot of guys that had speed and could steal 40, 50 bases every year. We had guys that would hit 20, 25 home runs. But I think our biggest asset was we knew how to play the artificial turf a lot better than most teams when they came in. And that was really a big advantage from our standpoint, because infielders have to play different a lot deeper back then they do nowadays. Balls got up on you a little bit quicker. So I think that we had a lot of guys that had a lot of good quickness within the infield, and that certainly helped our pitching staff. And our pitching staff helped the defense, because they always pitched fast and they were very confident, which made my job and a lot of others on the field certainly a lot easier. And I think that's why we won so many ball games.
Now, of course, defensively up the middle, you had yourself, Frank White, two of the greatest Royals infielders of all time. Tell me a little bit about your experiences with Frank White and, you know, working on those double plays.
Well, my experiences with Frank in the beginning was kind of entertaining for me. He was kind of, you know, when you're young like that, you come in and you're kind of lost. And of course, we had hitting charts, and you keep track of every pitch of every situation. And as a good infielder, you need to know all of those situations when they're coming up, what you want to do and how you want to prepare for them. And Frank wasn't quite ready for that. It took me about 3 years to finally get him into the groove to where he became pretty confident. But I used to call all the ball games, and 1 year in spring training we were playing the Yankees, and I just told him, I said, Frank, today you've got everything. And he kept yelling at me, and I never would look over at him. So I kind of forced him. I kind of forced his hand, and pretty much after that, his confidence really started to grow. And from the standpoint that he knew exactly what he was doing. But we studied and we worked a lot together. And it was the same way with George when George and Brett first came up. George was kind of new, and playing on that turf for some of those guys it had to be a little bit scary in the beginning. But of course, George made his adjustments, and then, you know, he's in the Baseball Hall of Fame, and Frank certainly turned his career around to where he was just one of the best second basemen to ever play the game.
Now, one of our guests later on the show is Johnny Giovitella, who's been up with the Royals
recently.
Another guy, he's 5'8", you know, a smaller guy, you know, just like yourself. What kind of challenges do you have, both just on the field, and also is there kind of a stigma that you felt when you were trying to make it as a big leaguer because you were just a smaller player?
Well, my stigma really was the fact that they were always looking for a way. They're always looking for a way to kind of get rid of the guys that are pretty short. And Giovitella at 5'8", I believe you mean, he's a lot bigger than I ever was, because I was like 5'5" and 140 pounds. But I think you had to work extra hard, and you knew what was going on. There was always somebody back behind you that wanted your job, but. I think just the love of the game and knowing how to play the game and what it takes to play the game the right way was really a big asset for me, and it certainly benefited myself for hanging around for about 13 years. So I just don't think you can allow things like that to bother you. Your size, they're certainly back there because you know that, you know, there are certain stigmas and things that people look at, but... I think the way that I handled myself and carried myself, I think people knew that, that I could play the game the way it needed to be played.
Well, I'll tell you, we're talking with Freddie Patek, Royals Hall of Famer here in the Kansas City Baseball Vault. And if Royals fans didn't already have confidence in folks who were maybe below 5'6", I believe there was a picture taken either this year or last year with you and Tim Collins. I think I saw that on the internet somewhere. And boy, he's another one of the fan favorites. He's certainly been able to turn his size into a strength.
Yeah, he's really fun to watch. I enjoy watching Tim pitch. I mean, he's a ball of energy out there. He has a lot of confidence, and he's just another one of those guys that his size doesn't really matter. Once he gets out on the field, you know, he's kind of a take charge guy, and he's not afraid to challenge the hitters. And you know, he's had a lot of success in, you know, last year and this year, and that's nice to see because he is small. And the other thing I like about him is he's left handed, and that really gives him a little bit more of an edge at times, because you got to have good left handed arms in the bullpen, and he's definitely one of the better arms that the Royals have down in that bullpen from the left side.
Hey, Freddie, it's Jeff Logan from the Kansas City Baseball Historical Society. How are you doing?
I'm good, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, I remember, and we've talked, I think, about this with you, that a lot of people don't remember how good you guys were. You know, you went out there, and you every time we'd go to watch you for $1.50, you guys won at home. So, it's a little different. But, you know, talking to some of the great players from the past with the Royals, what I've seen is how tough you guys were. You guys were tough, and you didn't take any crud from anybody. And, you know, and that meant the Yankees or any of these teams, you never backed down. Who were some of the tough guys that really motivated you guys to be that kind of team?
You mean from our side of the ball? Well, we had a lot of guys like that were, you know, you had to play with a chip on your shoulder, or you had to play a little bit meaner and a little bit nastier, because, you know, we were always chasing Oakland. But once we learned how to win, it became a lot easier for us. We had a lot of confidence in each other, and we had a lot of confidence in ourselves. And even if we were back 4, 5, 6 games at the All-Star break, when the All-Star game was over, it was like somebody would walk into the clubhouse, turn on the light switch, and we would just take off and just kind of, you know, we'd win everything, and our pitches were good. They were consistent. They made good pitches. And when you have ball clubs like that with speed and power and good pitching and we had outstanding defense. We were really probably underrated as far as from a defensive standpoint. But our biggest strength was in the 7th, 8th, and 9th innings when there was runners on base. We always knew that we were going to turn a double play no matter what. And that saved us an awful lot. Our pitchers knew that, and they pitched to contact, and we did very, very well in those types of situations.
Go ahead, Troy.
Well, I was just going to say, Freddie, you played with three teams, as we mentioned, the Pirates, the Royals, and the Angels. Mostly your career was spent with the Royals. Do you, as you watch baseball in this day and age, do you still align yourself with any of the teams? Like, do you get excited when you see the Angels and Pirates do well, or frustrated when you watch the Royals continue to struggle?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I do enjoy watching Pittsburgh, and it's nice to see that they're playing well. And, of course, Clint Hurdle was a member of our ball club back in the 70s, and now he's the manager of the Pirates, and he's done a great job when he was in, I think he was in Colorado for a while. But, when I was with the Angels, it was a different atmosphere there. And I was very fortunate, I think, throughout the most of my career that I played on good ball clubs, especially when I was with Pittsburgh. You know, we went to the divisional playoffs, and then come here to Kansas City, and we Cedric Talas and John Scherholz, guys like that, build a good organization through good trades from other ball clubs, Hal McRae out of Cincinnati and Wayne Simpson and Amos Otis from the Mets. So they put together a really good ball club, and I thought it was a really good mix. And then when you have guys like Whitey Herzog who knew how to put the pieces of that puzzle together, and to know where its strengths and its weaknesses were, I think Whitey did a great job doing that. But it was a lot of fun playing on those teams because you just knew when you came out at the second half of the year after the All-Star break, like I said, you just knew you were going to win and take control. And it didn't matter if we were playing in Chicago where they were pretty hostile against us, or if we were down in Texas playing against the Rangers, we would face their best. And even though we did, we knew we were going to win. It was you had to be there kind of to experience that. It was a lot of fun when you got a chance to do it.
Now, going back to talking about your size a little bit, you're listed at 5'5", but there were some reports you could have been maybe only 5'4". But there's another gentleman down in Houston now that is also 5'5", middle infielder for the Astros, Jose Altuve.
Yeah.
And this being the social media age, everybody's had a lot of fun with Altuve. And there's actually a thing of how many Altuves is something, using it as a unit of measure. And you, sir, are exactly one Altuve. Have you kind of enjoyed watching him come into the major leagues and play and thinking to yourself, man, I remember, you know, playing in the middle infield, being that size and seeing how well he's doing?
Yeah, you enjoy watching a guy that has a lot of zest and a lot of energy and a lot of, you know, and just has a love and a passion for the game. And it doesn't take, you don't have to watch very long to see when guys have that kind of ability, or even that he's only 5'5". But, he's an outstanding player, and he's fun to watch. I don't get to see that much of the Houston Astros, although I was born and raised about 150 miles from Houston. It's very unusual that you see a guy that size nowadays, because a lot of the athletes, when I look at them now, boy, they're just so much bigger and stronger. It's amazing.
We're finishing up. I got a few more minutes with the middle infielder, Royals Hall of Famer, and three-time All-Star Freddie Patek. I was at a coffee shop the other day, and we were talking about the Royals, and the person I was with says, you know, I wonder what would happen if Ewing Kauffman, you know, came back from the grave and saw what's going on with the Royals today. You played for Mr. Kauffman, and obviously Whitey Herzog was your manager. What was that like to play for Mr. K? I remember hearing Willie Wilson tell a story about it was very family oriented, and you know, it was like you were in his family. What was that dynamic with Mr. K?
Well, I think Mr. K was a very highly motivated individual, just like even if he were a professional player. That's the way that he ran his business, you know, Miriam Labs, and he wanted to win her. He would do whatever it would take to put a winning product on the field. He hired great baseball people for the front office that made a lot of good trades. But, you know, he would go the extra mile to do whatever it would take, even if it was one player, maybe two players that we might need to add. And certainly he wasn't afraid to spend the money. And we got a lot of guys that were on our big league ball club that came out of the Royals minor league system that turned out to be really good players, guys like Tommy Poquette and Jimmy Wolford and Joe Zeb, some of those, just to name a few. But you could always tell, and even when, and we didn't see him very much. I think he was in a clubhouse maybe twice the whole time I was there. But you always knew that you could count on him to find somebody to help this ball club win. He wasn't going to let it go down. I think that's why this organization, why this ball club was so good for so many years while he was still alive.
Now, of course, you have done some analysis. I know you were an analyst for NBC for a while, and you've done more recently stuff for the Royals. Final question, what would be one thing that you might do to fix this Royals club and to make it a contender moving forward?
Oh, wow.
Well, where do you start, right?
You put a lot on the plate, yeah. What I see right now, I like. I mean, it's not anything new that I did. You know, it's pretty much what I thought it was going to be from the beginning of the year. It was going to be like peaks and valleys and waves at different times, mm-hmm. whether it was pitching or hitting or defense, base running, trying to put all those pieces together, you know, to win. And you have to have good pitching, hitting, and defense at the same time to really be a good ball club and win a lot of ball games, and that's certainly what we did. But there's a lot of good talent on this ball club right now. And these guys are like a year. This is only the first or second year, and I think you're going to see a big difference next year and the year after. And it all is going to hinge upon what we know as starting pitching. And if their starting pitching can do the job and get them to six or seven innings and keep them close in ball games, I certainly believe that this ball club is going to hit. They certainly are a good defensive ball club, and the guys right now, that the Hosmers and the Moustakas and the others, their performance within a couple of years, I think people are really going to enjoy and see what these guys can put together. But they are all-star players, and they are going to be a very good ball club in about two more years if we get the pitching that we need.
Well, it's always nice to have players like yourself in, Freddie, a hometown hero, the guys that chose to stay in Kansas City. And we sure appreciate you coming in tonight. And thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you soon.
Dave, guys, not a problem. I appreciate it. Thanks for bringing up some of the good memories. I appreciate that. You guys have a great week.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.